So I started to think about it, and I thought, liturgical art and architecture being a part of the liturgy is also catechetical in a way. First, what do we mean by catechesis? How would you define that word? Okay, teaching. Yeah. Any other aspect of it? Oh, good. Okay, excellent. Passing down the faith, learning the faith. And usually when you think about catechesis, you think about it in what kind of a context? Okay. Usually when you think about catechesis, you think about it in what kind of a context? Okay, like a class. And in the traditional churches, like ours, the formal catechesis process is usually leading up to what? Okay, good, confirmation. Usually it's confirmation. So you are learning doctrines and dogmas and learning scripture, and you're learning church history and tradition and all kinds of things that we as traditionalists think are wonderful things. But it's a process that is largely, I suppose, it is largely, come on in, Chris. It's largely cerebral, I guess, right? It has to do with the mind, I suppose. But as I was studying liturgical art and architecture as a subset of the liturgy, it occurred to me that the church from the beginning has also seen, really has seen the liturgy as the primary catechizer of Christians. And that is partly cerebral and intellectual, but it's also what? I mean, there are ways to learn other than just the rational. Yeah, there's a little chart here. I put this kind of in the wrong order, but this little chart here, number 4 on your... really, the liturgy engages and catechizes the whole person. The Enlightenment tended to emphasize the mind and the mental. This is a good thing. Of course, God wants us to use our mind and to reason. But really, we're a whole being. We're a whole being. And the liturgy engages and teaches our whole being, body, soul, and mind. I thought this was a neat little chart that I pulled out of one of my resources here. Earthly liturgy in the senses, in other words, we're catechized through the liturgy, our sense of taste. All senses here are dealt with. Our sense of taste, in the Eucharist we taste the heavenly food. In holy orders, the priest acts in the person of Christ, symbolically in the liturgy. In persona Christi is the old Latin phrase. So with our eyes, we're seeing the activity of Christ played out before us. Now, liturgical art and architecture is just one of these subsets of liturgy. We'll talk a little bit more about today. With liturgical art and architecture, we see the world restored. We see a radiant vision of heaven, and that will become the central theme of our workshop, is seeing the radiant vision of heaven as we're catechized through the liturgy. Of course, in liturgical music, we hear order, the order and harmonious nature of the heavenly city. Through scripture and through preaching, of course, we hear, we're engaged with our intellect through our ears, through hearing. Flowers and incense. The liturgy and especially the architecture of the historic church has an Edenic theme. It's garden-like. What do we mean by that? You think of anything in the temple or the tabernacle that was Edenic, garden-like?
Okay.
Okay.
Okay. There's carvings and embroidery.
Yeah.
With the tree.
There were gourds and palm trees carved into the cedar, and something else. Pomegranates. There were flowers.
Lots of images.
But what is interesting is inside the temple, that those garden decorations weren't painted. They weren't painted with red and blue and green colors. They were overlaid with gold. What's the symbolism there, do you think? Well, you might even think that what's being said is that... What's that? In a sense, but what's really being communicated through that sign is that Eden will be restored to you, but it will be even better. It'll be even better. So it's not painted with, you know, what you think. You know, these are gold flowers and gold pomegranates and things. And we do flowers in our churches too, on our altars, right? And of course, when you see that, you're to remember the garden. Remember that's what this is all about, restoring the garden to us in heaven. Of course, gold, silk, marble, and the hand of a neighbor. We touch the world restored and glorified by God. In all these ways, you think it's valid to say that we're being catechized? So if we think of catechism for confirmation as being prepared to be confirmed, and this usually is a class that lasts a few months, 6 months, could last a year. If the liturgy is a perpetual catechism that lasts our whole life, what are we being catechized for? We're being prepared for. Yeah, it's so I think that's why the church has seen the liturgy as the primary catechizer of Christians in their life, getting them ready for heaven. And I think, you know, I have a background kind of in free church evangelicalism. And we, you know, even in seminary, I mean, I had all these hours and hours and hours of classes at a Bible college and at a seminary. And we really never talked about church architecture. They never told us there's a proper way to build a church. They never told us that. And so, when a lot of free church evangelicals, you know, non-traditional, non-liturgical Christians build churches, what do you think that their primary, what's the primary driving force that they have in mind when they build it? Besides how much it costs. Of course, that's going to be, well, we have to live in reality. But, well, if you want to think in theological terms, it's usually about the centrality of preaching and arranging people in the way so that they can hear what's being said. If you think in non-theological, well, yeah, but that, even that is what? Pragmatic. So what is the driving force behind non-liturgical church building?
Utilitarianism.
Okay. There's no rhyme or reason to why things look a certain way, why they're shaped a certain way, why things are arranged a certain way. It's just a meeting hall. It's a space to meet in. And when you understand that, you can understand why that when you go in, you aren't really overwhelmed with what? You're really not. It's sort of like feels like walking into a movie theater. When you walk into a movie theater, do you feel like it's a holy place? Really, no, right? These days, no. These days, yeah. These days, absolutely not. But the historic church was never like that. It was never like that. What do you think? Because the historic church has always practiced a theology or a hermeneutic. You know that word? It just means hermeneutic. It's kind of a fancy word that means how you interpret literature. It doesn't necessarily have to do with the Bible. It means how you interpret anything. We're using it to mean how you interpret the Bible. Now, my seminary I went to, the way you approach the Bible is radical discontinuity from Old Testament to New Testament. In other words, when things transition from Old Testament to New, everything's different. Nothing carries forward. There's no continuity from old to new. So it makes sense when they think about building a church, what's in their mind is not necessarily what's revealed back where. Okay, that's exactly right. So when the historic, somebody once said, all the great church builders of history, the temple was not far from the front of their minds at all times. At all times. Father Scott told me that when he teaches this class, he always asks people up front, he says, does God care what your church looks like? Does He care the way it's arranged and the way it's shaped and the ornamentation and colors inside? And is He interested in all that? And he says 95% of people say, they'd say, no, God doesn't care about any of that stuff. Now, if you draw a line when the book of Matthew starts and you say everything's new, everything that God said back here doesn't apply, then that makes perfect sense. But we in the historic churches are what we would call whole Bible Christians, right? We're whole Bible Christians. Is it the primitive Baptists, I want to say, who don't have music? Don't do music? And they don't do music because it's not repeated in the what? Okay, now that is a...
They don't do instrumental music. They sing. They just don't do instrumental.
And is it for that reason? Because instruments are not repeated in the New Testament? The Old Testament is full of instruments. What instruments are stated? The harp, the lyre, the...
cymbals.
Yeah. Singing, but I don't know that it mentions instruments. So their understanding of radical discontinuity from old to new is so radical that they say, unless it's repeated, we're not going to have organs or anything. Well, that's sort of sad. I mean, the people of God suffer because of that false understanding of things. But I think that's taking that understanding of discontinuity to its logical ends, in a sense. Right. That's well said. That's exactly right. However, as the temple's revealed in Exodus 25, I'm sorry, the tabernacle and the temple's revealed in 1 Chronicles 28, early Christians saw both as types of what? Foreshadowings of what? When early Christians read about the temple and tabernacle in Exodus and temple in 1 Chronicles, they saw those buildings as foreshadowings of what? Of anticipations of what?
Christ
and His church. They saw it as foreshadowings of the Christian church. As a matter of fact, they saw early sanctuaries as little outposts of heaven on earth. As a matter of fact, a lot of old churches in Europe you go to, and above the door it says, the gates of heaven. Sort of Lewis's old idea of the wardrobe, right? This is a touch point between the two places. This is the wardrobe where you can go into and go into another world for a little while. Be lifted up into heaven and worship, and then be sent back down. Come back out through the wardrobe and come back out. The church at worship has always been the church militant, expectant, and triumphant, right? The idea is that the church is bigger than you think. Church is bigger than you think. As a matter of fact, the church not only spans the whole earth, but it flows up into where? We're in the same church as they're in. Okay? It's one church, even in heaven. All these realities are somewhat invisible to the eye. The early church fathers, some of whom were known as mystagogues. You ever heard that word? Mystagogue. Cyril of Jerusalem and John Chrysostom and Augustine. There are some lesser known ones, but mystagogy, M-Y-S-T-A-G-O-G-Y, is simply defined as guidance in the mysteries. Guidance in things hidden from the foundation of the world. The mystagogue guided his congregation, especially new Christians, through external and material things to grasp unseen reality, spiritual, inner, divine things. The mystagogue could show liturgical and sacramental signs that have been foreshadowed in the Old Testament, revealed in the New Testament, and could trace development from Old Testament to New Testament to heaven. That's an important theme, especially when you think of church architecture. In the Old Testament, the temple again was a model of what? It foreshadowed the coming church, but it was a model. The way it was laid out, they laid it out based upon what?
The tabernacle was the ascension. They laid it out by the ascension to God on the mount.
Okay.
In the Garden of Eden.
It was a representative of what? Yes, and where's the throne room of God? It was a representation of heaven. The temple was laid out like heaven, you know, and the altar and the chancel, you know, was to be heavenly. In other words, when you go over to our church, it's broken into three parts. What do you go into? First thing you go into. You get your bulletin and everything. First thing you go into. The narthex. Then you go into the nave. And then what's it called back up behind the rail? Technically it's called the chancel. The sanctuary is the slab that the altar sits on. And that represents what? Well, okay. The temple was the same way. The narthex represents the porch. The nave represents the holy place. And what was the small place? Holy of Holies. That's right. So that's why usually only clergy are allowed to go up on the slab where the altar is. It's a picture of heaven. God is preparing His people to recognize the heavenly city, even in the Old Testament. He gives them a representation of what heaven is going to be like in the tabernacle and then in the temple and then in the New Testament church.
It's not out there.
What do you mean?
It's Eden. It's the garden recreated.
That's a good point. That's the point of the Edenic garden theme. What did they mistake Christ for when He was resurrected? That's not an accident. He's the great gardener that restores what? Restores Eden to us. The idea of the New Testament church is that God has invited His people back into the garden through His Son. So we go into a church that has flowers and stained glass windows that has beautiful color, has a garden theme. But these These senses have been lost in the modern church architecture. Even in, and I don't know that they've been lost in Orthodoxy. The Orthodox still build churches that are, you know, self-consciously theological. But in the Catholic Church, it was lost for a while. Since the 60s, they built some pretty ugly churches too. You know, don't you think? I mean, we always pick on the Baptists and people like that for building ugly churches, but the Catholics have built some ugly churches too. Faddish, modern. You're exactly right.
But there's no new washable, it's not new at all, but the southern part is a beautiful cathedral.
Traditionalist. When a church doesn't look like a church, it betrays its theological form is betrayed by its built form. In other words, it's not taking its own side. You look at a church that looks like a cube or whatever, and your first question is, whose side are you on? Because you look like you're on the world side. You have said, look at me, I'm for the world. You haven't... Yeah, we're just like you. Come on in. We've got dancers and, you know, rock bands and all that stuff. You know, the old humorous definition of a liberal is somebody that won't even take their own side in an argument. When the church doesn't look like the church, it's not even taking its own side with its architecture. The purpose of sacred architecture is to give the church a proper space for the celebration of the mysteries. We must relearn to contemplate and respect sacred space. Now, back in another life, when I was, like I said, in Free Church Evangelicalism, there wasn't this kind of undercurrent of respect for the sacred space. Before the service started, what was going on in there? I mean, this is in the nave. I'm not talking about in the narthex. I mean, in the nave. People tuning up instruments, loud noises, the drummer, you know, getting ready, the AV guy running around, you know, trying to get the AV right, people talking, back slapping. As we say in Anglicanism, that's what coffee hour is for, you know. But it makes sense. They're not trying to be rebellious and they're not trying to be mean. They're living out their theology. Because why? There's no respect for sacred space. There's no understanding that this space is sacred. This is a consecrated space where God enters into in a special sacramental way. If it's just like a movie theater, well, let's just treat it like that. We can talk and, you know. And it isn't meant to make you feel holy. Even people who don't understand all these theological underpinnings from the temple and restored Eden and all the reasons, all the things we're being taught, even those that don't understand it, when they walk into a truly beautiful cathedral in Europe, even if they don't understand any of this stuff we're talking about, what's that? Even when they, what do they say usually? Now this is, now that's valid. They're not doing anything intellectual. They're not doing anything rational. This is, you know, the Enlightenment would tend to downplay intuition and just understanding things through. But when somebody walks into a church and they say, now this feels like a church is supposed to, that's valid. That's valid. They're supposed to feel that way. The architecture is supposed to do that. It's supposed to transport them and give them a taste of what? Not the movie theater. Of heaven. Liturgical art and architecture is part of the liturgy. It's not a neutral space whereby the liturgy is done. It's part of it. It's part of it. The art and the architecture is an organic part of the liturgy itself. I think we tended to, back in, you know, the old days, I just tended to think of it as just a neutral space, just a shell, a stage upon which a play was played out. I didn't realize that the actual space itself was so important and a part of the liturgy itself too. And I don't mean to be elitist about this either, because I understand, believe me, being a rector of a small parish, I understand the realities of life. And those realities are, a lot of small parishes don't have a lot of money. And a lot of small parishes have to do what they can for space. You know, you might have to meet in an auditorium, or you might have to meet in a converted parish hall like my parish worships. And so I'm not saying that you have to be spectacular and expensive to... Hey, Father. How are you? But you can still follow these principles, I think. Beauty also plays into... Yes, sir?
Going on with that, what are some practical suggestions that you would have for, say, a church plant mission kind of context with a newly formed parish that doesn't have your own space yet? How do you promote? What are some practical ways to promote this?
Well, I think, you know, you just do the best you can to structure it liturgically. You know, you chancel as best you can. You have a traditional nave and a narthex as best you can. And you just have to do the best you can, right, Father? If you don't have a big church and you're meeting in an auditorium or in a parish hall, converted parish hall or whatever, you use the same liturgical principles of liturgical art and architecture, beauty, as best you can with the resources that you have, I think. You wear your proper vestments and your linens, you use the right liturgical colors, and you try to get beautiful candles and flowers, and you do the best you can. Beauty is another important aspect of church building that has been lost in recent centuries. And these days, in the culture in which we live, beauty isn't as easy to define as you might think. Well, let me ask you all, how do you define this word beauty? For a long time in antiquity, it was pretty well defined. But these days, it's become very fuzzy, difficult to pin down. Excellent. You're not using the word, but what you're getting at is essence.
Yes.
The essence of a thing.
Yes.
The dogness of a dog. You know, I met this artist once who was a landscape artist here in town. He did Western art and a lot of money doing Western. I didn't know there was a lot of money in Western art, but he made bucking broncos in bronze and stuff like that and made a lot of money. But he didn't get into that because there's a lot of money in it. He got into it because he started out as a portrait artist. And he said, I couldn't do it. I couldn't do it. He said, I can make it look like them, but I couldn't capture their essence. You know, there's a special gift to portrait painting, and not every artist has it. I think he was getting at what beauty is, to capture the essence of a thing. Beauty, or the essence, their reality as it is understood in the mind of God, perhaps. Beauty is the compelling power of truth. It draws us out of ourselves to investigate a beautiful thing. Heavenly beauty is ours in our art and architecture, but only through the mode of sacrament. What do we mean by that? I want to take a stab at that. Heavenly beauty is ours through our art and architecture, but only through the mode of sacrament.
We can't transcend what we see in this life without going through our sacraments.
Excellent. Heavenly realities are mediated through material things of liturgy. Excellent. A church building with its liturgical art teaches us, like nothing else can, what heaven looks like, who is there, and what the nature of redeemed creation might be like. So again, it's sort of a lifelong catechesis, the liturgy, preparing us for heaven. It gives us a foretaste of those realities by way of image. So the architect must remember that even in the church age, architecture and art within the church are not subject to whim or fad, but are governed by heavenly realities. You know the part of the Lord's Prayer, "Thy will be done." So that's the model for architects, as best you can, to do it on earth, for the liturgist also, on earth as it is in heaven. It's being done in heaven. All revelation of God is clear, whole, and ordered, and so should our art and architecture be. A liturgical art and architecture must be about salvation, primarily. There are some classical architectural principles that early church builders used. These are primarily Thomistic. Again, a beautiful object or a beautiful church gives the viewer knowledge of the inner logic of its being through three principles. These are Latin words: integritas, claritas, and consonantia. Integritas has to do with wholeness of a building or art. It means a being has all it needs to have in order to be complete. Otherwise, it is incomplete and less beautiful than it otherwise would be. The second principle that that they used to build churches was claritas, or proportionality. The physical dimensions of a building or a work of art. Also its correspondence to an ideal, the end or purpose of it. In other words, we're talking about the church that looks like a restaurant or something like that. It doesn't reflect the end or purpose that it's meant to do. And consonantia is the radiant clarity of inner being, the power of an object to impress knowledge of itself on the mind of the perceiver. These are important in church buildings because perceiving heavenly realities and earthly matters makes us heavenly ourselves, ready for eternity. Again, traditional church architecture shows the fulfillment of temple ritual and anticipates the heavenly Jerusalem. It's the in-between time where we do things on earth as it is in heaven. In modern times, however, even in the traditional churches, sometimes an aesthetic theology has become dominant over theological aesthetic. In other words, human theories have become more important to the building of churches than revelation. Human theories equal shallow buildings. You might think of it that way. Are most recent churches that you've seen built worthy of taking your out-of-town guests to see? Or usually would you rather drive by them and go down to the old downtown cathedral for the most part? And the limited budgets and so on are, you know, the realities of life are part of that. Yeah, I mean, that's a really important point. Yeah. Since the Enlightenment, however, beauty has often been divorced from its roots, you might say. Put in the realm of subjective perception, the emotions, or dilettante experts. To the modern critic, if it moves the viewer, then it must be beautiful. Many modern places ban the word beauty altogether, saying that it is unknowable, indefinable, and embarrassingly bourgeois. Critics often routinely praise ugly, arbitrary things, right? You can just see them sipping their champagne in Greenwich Village and looking at the canvas spattered with paint and talking about how beautiful, right? But that's not the traditional understanding of beauty at all. Again, beauty is the whatness of a thing, the dogness of a dog. Is a crucifix beautiful? Okay. Keeping in mind the essence of something, beauty being capturing the essence. What does that capture the essence of? It captures the essence of a term that is like beauty, seemingly indefinable in modern minds. It captures the essence of love. The essence of love is captured by looking at Christ on the cross. Great art, great church buildings, great liturgical art is not art, is not great because it is faddish. It's great because it is capable of a flash of understanding in a tangible earthly thing. So when we're thinking about liturgical architecture and art, the flash of understanding should be about primarily what? And most specifically, heaven. Most specifically, heaven. Yeah. Great liturgical art and architecture is in its essence heavenly. It's transformative and transportive to heaven. It must be rooted in sacramental theology. A building, again, is a sacramental thing, not just a place to meet. Not just a neutral meeting hall. A beautiful church is the image of heaven. You might think of architecture as the built form of ideas. Church architecture is the built form of theology. And let me ask you this question. We believe as traditionalists that there is right belief and right practice. If you believe in the creeds, you believe there's right belief, right? You believe in the liturgy, you believe that there's right practice. Is there right building? Modern people say no. Well, they don't say that there's right or wrong anything, right? Everything's the same. But if you believe that there's right belief and you believe that there's right practice, is there right or wrong building when it comes to building a church and doing liturgical art?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Little vestiges of an old ancient teaching called Gnosticism, right? And they innocently do that. They are not trying to be Gnostic heretics. They are innocently doing that. But this whole idea that things can't be holy, the material world is kind of inherently sinful and evil, and the only thing that can be good is that which is pure spirit and non-physical. Those are subconscious undercurrents that operate in their thinking, and they don't realize that. Sacramentalists, the sacramental worldview is the opposite of the Gnostic worldview. It says that God uses His creation, physical creation. I mean, we ask the question, why did Jesus have to have a flesh and blood body? He could have been an apparition, or he could have worked pure spirit, could have been sort of like a ghost. Why did he need to be flesh and blood? And actually, that's the answer to the old Gnostic belief or teaching that physical matter is inherently evil. Well, Christ had a physical body. What did he say to Thomas? Yet he never sinned. So physical things are not evil just because they're physical. As a matter of fact, God tends to work His grace through physical things like bread, wine, yeah, the creation itself, oil, water. Yeah, His grace, you might think of physical creation as a conduit of God's grace. And He can go around the physical in certain instances, but His normal way to do things is not to bypass His physical creation, is to use it. That's a good thing, because that way I have a job. He uses flesh and blood people to be His clergy, and He uses a flesh and blood spouse. That's why marriage is a sacrament. You know, you have a flesh and blood spouse that His grace comes through. Your spouse is a conduit of God's grace to you. So all that you're describing is sort of vestiges of Gnosticism. Now, they don't realize that.
No, and they think sacramentalism as superstition.
Mm-hmm. I think they try to, in the void, they try to give an enhanced... they try to create a spiritual atmosphere through their music, if you have a little board, which they don't seem to do anything. It's through their efforts.
Creating mood and so on.
Yeah.
Well, that brings me to another question I'm asking you. Is there right or wrong building? Is there right or wrong music? Because back when, you know, I was, like I'm saying, in that evangelical world, you couldn't really say that any style of music was wrong. The words were what mattered. So you could have, like, really metal, you know, heavy metal music, as long as the words were right. Okay, so now what's wrong with that? Is there right music or wrong music?
Well, at the very least, music should act like the architecture. A Gothic cathedral points to God.
Okay.
Music, I'm very hesitant to say a particular type of music can't be used as long as it's pointing to God. But that's the crucial thing. Much of the music points to the musicians, it points to the culture, and in fact, it points away from God rather than pointing to God.
Does music create moods? Yeah, you listen to a certain album, and if you want to be put in a certain mood, you know the albums that will do that. Well, is there a certain mood that is appropriate for the holiness of the moment of the divine liturgy? Okay, so certain styles of music, are they going to create that mood? So, there's right music. Yes, ma'am.
I was just going to say that, you know, when we think about the music, who is it pleasing? Is it pleasing to your God? You know, music that isn't, you know, not just saying solemn, but that isn't, you know, doesn't give you like a reverent attitude.
Yeah.
It's just pleasing you. You know, like, I want to go to church so I can hear this sort of music.
Yeah.
I really love listening to the radio.
Right.
Cars.
And I think that certain groups who use music that create adrenaline in church, they tend to confuse adrenaline with the Holy Spirit, right? So when they come out of that and they come into a musical style that is reverent, that doesn't create adrenaline, they think, this church is dead. The Spirit's not here. They say, no, your adrenaline's not pumping. They're sort of addicted to that. And they have to go on withdrawals and understand that music is not supposed to make you feel adrenaline. It's supposed to make you feel like you're in the presence of holiness. And yeah, Chris?
Yeah, the subjectivity of the subject and how battles ensue are what style of music. But one of the things that the wisdom of the church in this area has been to move slowly. And with groups within the church working and analyzing and seeing what's appropriate, both musically and lyrically. And so, for example, when we, REC, or our parish gave us a 1940 hymnal, that hymnal was put together. It was a painstaking process to put that together.
Okay.
So there's group and church wisdom and how that's put together. It's not just one person showing up on Sunday morning saying, I heard this song, yes, great, let's use it.
Right.
It helps you worship. You're told because the worship music is to be worshipful.
right.
Which is not focused on you, but on God, then are we being too presumptuous and being critical of potential music that is not necessarily our taste or experience in a spiritual setting? Might there not be some music that, if people find it helps them worship, then that's the point, isn't it?
I think I would defer to Chris's answers. Really, the church is the church's job to discern that over time. That's a good way of putting it, Chris. Yeah. Yes, sir.
Not to belabor the point, but I've been involved in non-liturgical music ministries in the past part of life, and a lot of it does tend to be very focused on trying to recapture within the corporate worship setting what people are comfortable with in their daily life. They want it to be pleasing and acceptable and accessible to the culture, and that's all that tends to be the primary motivation behind a lot of the sentiment.
And in many ways, that sentiment has been the driving force behind a movement in church architecture that you might think of as domestic church architecture. The movement to build churches that make people feel like they're at home. If you go into a neighborhood and see a church that was maybe built in the 70s, and they did lots in the 70s, but if it was a neighborhood of three-bedroom, two-bath ranchers, they kind of made the church look like that and feel like that inside. But what's wrong with that? What is it not doing that it's supposed to do? Well, when you go to church, if you live in suburbia, you want to go to church and feel like you got to live in suburbia forever? What do you want to feel like is going to happen to you someday?
One day
I'll fly away someday, you know, and that's what I want to be reminded of. I want to go into an atmosphere that is holy and wholly other, that doesn't look like my neighborhood, doesn't feel like the house I live in. I want to be reminded that there's something far better than this someday. There's something far more beautiful and far more holy, something that's in the presence of God. I don't want to be, you know, I don't want to just go to a thing that looks like a house. And I think that's what you're talking about too. Music, in a sense, should do that too. It shouldn't sound like what you just listened to on the radio. That's why in liturgical art, if you look at some modern liturgical art, the people depicted are depicted very realistically, almost like a photograph. Whereas in the old days when they did liturgical art, the people were not depicted that way. How were they depicted? Well, the saints and so on, how were they depicted? Many times there was a radiance about them. There was a look on their face that is otherworldly. Liturgical art that is too realistic is communicating that the people in the picture are going to be bound to the effects of sin forever. Liturgical art that depicts people in a heavenly light is telling you what? They're going to transcend the chains of their sin someday and be transformed and be made like Christ and be made heavenly. That's why when you go to the Christian bookstore and all this, you know, very realistic modern Christian art leaves you. It's supposed to, you know, when you look at a saintly painting that was painted in the 15th century, it's transformed. And so that principle works in music, architecture, and art, liturgically speaking.
There's a, just for those of you that want to pursue this, you can go online, and Ken Myers from Marshall Audio did a series of four lectures on beauty and music. He had one of the lectures was called Carol Kind of Music Arts. And in those four lectures, he lays out objective standards and criteria for beauty, for art, architecture, music, that are very well founded. Everybody knows when something's ugly. Everyone knows when something's beautiful. He goes beautiful. He goes through and enlarges on beauty. It really is the glory of God showing through the work of man. There's certain principles that he draws out that he used to do that.
And the liturgical artist uses these principles with the help of the Holy Spirit to do what you just said. And did everybody hear that Mars Hill audio? Ken Myers is really good.
Yeah, if you Google Edwards Institute and Ken Myers, he did four lectures. Don't just go for Edwards Institute, Ken Myers.
He spoke here at this conference a couple years ago. He was very good. Well, I guess the last thing is, if you're clergy, of course you all know these things, but if you're laity and you're going to be on a building committee someday, keep this in mind. Know that church architecture is not subjective, but it has been revealed by God what He wants. And there's a model for us in the tabernacle and the temple and the church fathers and all the great church builders of Europe and so on. And that's the great thing about tradition, being a traditionalist. So many of the hard things have already been figured out for you. You don't have to make it all up and figure it all out. It's already there. Just take advantage of all the wonderful, wonderful things that have been done, all the gold that has been mined through the centuries for you. Anyway, I don't think we have time for questions. Lucky me. But I think he wanted everybody. We have a. Are we going to the church? Or I didn't see the schedule. Thank you very much. Thank you.